This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Great to see you all. Enjoyed a late night conversation last night on my Eastern Time Zone body clock. Still all good. It's great. Have enjoyed hearing some of your stories, and I'm less intimidated today, I think. I do want to make one plug, if I could. In my spare time, I edit a quarterly magazine called Comment Magazine, which is the tagline for which is Public Theology for the Common Good. I only mention this because I really am excited and believe a lot in this project. It's a quarterly print magazine with then online articles every Friday, covering a range of sort of Christian witness to culture, public engagement, justice, and so on. And one of my passions coming in as editor is actually to re-emphasize the importance of the church informing people who are passionate about justice. And so putting that the ecclesial center back into that picture. So in the table in the back, I've brought a sample copy you can look at, and then there are some brochures that give you an editor's rate, a little break, if you're interested in signing up. So that's just for your interest. You'll remember in your red packets there are outlines to follow along with my rambling. Today we're in session 2, talking about postmodern discipleship. And this morning, think of yesterday as sort of an overview shot across the bow kind of approach. And now each of the subsequent days, I want to dive a little deeper on different elements of that. But before diving in, maybe it would be helpful to review and just get ourselves back up to speed where we were at. Here's how I would summarize the argument yesterday. I guess you know the speaker is a philosopher when the point is an argument, right? Philosophers are always making arguments, which means we are trying to convince you of something, which there is a little bit of irony in that project, but let's put it this way. We are what we love, and we love what we worship. That's one way to summarize yesterday. We are what we love, and we love what we worship. But here's the second sort of theme to that. Our loves are trained by worship. Our loves are trained by worship. So it's not just an expressive claim. We are what we love, and what we love leads us to worship it. There's actually also a formative claim going on here, which is that what we worship shapes what we fundamentally love. That's what it means to say that human beings are liturgical animals. So our loves, our desires, our longings, our most fundamental passions are not things that we wake up on Monday morning and choose. Well, I mean, you can do that. You can wake up on Monday morning and say, today I choose to love God and His kingdom. You should do that. The problem is, if all you're doing is articulating that choice, do you find by about Thursday, that's not really sticking? Or 3 o'clock. Tuesday, yeah, 3 o'clock Monday, right. So there's something else going on here, and that's it's one thing for me to say I agree with Wendell Berry. It's another thing for me to stop eating at Costco, right? And this is where we need to appreciate this sense of love as habit. And think about habit formation. Liturgies, these forms of worship, shape and train and aim our loves to some ultimate vision of the good life, of the kingdom. And so what's at issue here is, what do we love? What liturgies are we immersed in? And what are they training and habituating us to long for? What vision or version of the good life have we been trained to love? Is everybody with me? Does that make sense? Liturgies, then, are those practices, rituals that are love-shaping. They are fundamentally character-forming. So, here's how we'll transition today. Think of liturgies as pedagogies of desire. Pedagogies are teaching strategies, training strategies. Liturgies are pedagogies of desire. Liturgies are tangible communal rituals and practices that teach us to love some version of the kingdom. But the way they teach us is not didactic. That's what we need to start to appreciate. The way we learn to love some ultimate vision of the good life of the kingdom is not didactic. It's not just by depositing ideas in our heads. It is something much more like a sentimental education. If any of you know Flaubert, you'll get the allusion there. Actually, Flaubert's novel, A Sentimental Education, is a really beautiful picture of this point, which is how a young man from the provinces is basically acclimated to the bourgeoisie in Paris. And it's not because when he gets to Paris, somebody sits down and says, here are all the things the bourgeoisie believe. Do you know what I mean? It's because he's immersed in a way of life that makes him that kind of person. It's a sentimental education, not an intellectual education primarily. And yet, it's that sentimental education that is so powerful. So let's think about, then, discipleship as a sentimental education. Remember I told you, you have to forget everything you ever learned from Hallmark? So I'm trying to redeem the word sentimental here. And taking it away from, you know, puppy dogs and soppiness, I mean the education of our sentiments, our sensibilities. You know, it's interesting. These are all free footnotes, by the way. But so we're all probably familiar with Adam Smith's Bible of capitalism called The Wealth of Nations, or you've at least heard of it, right? Before Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote a book called A Theory of Moral Sentiments. And I would say one of the things that's gone wrong in our culture is that we inherited The Wealth of Nations without inheriting A Theory of Moral Sentiments. And what's interesting here is The Theory of Moral Sentiments precisely recognized something about this, what I'm calling our gut level orientation to the world. And that's a way to think about what we're up to today. I'm going to do it a little differently with David Brooks. You're going to think like me and David Brooks are like best friends. That's not true. But there was a great column that David Brooks had in the New York Times about, this is probably a couple of years ago, maybe even 3 years ago now. And it talks about his experience of going to a concert. Listen, I've given you the quotes because I think they're juicy quotes and I don't want you to have to just listen to them. Here's the first. Like many of you, I went to elementary school, high school, and college. I took such and such classes, earned such and such grades, and amassed such and such degrees. But on the night of February 2nd, 1975, I turned on WMMR in Philadelphia and became mesmerized by a concert the radio station was broadcasting. The concert was by a group I'd never heard of, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. Thus began a part of my second education. We don't usually think of this second education. For reasons having to do with the peculiarities of our civilization, we pay a great deal of attention to our scholastic educations, which are formal and supervised, and we devote much less public thought to our emotional educations, which are unsupervised and haphazard. This is odd, since our emotional educations are much more important to our long-term happiness and the quality of our lives. Okay? So Brooks introduces this notion that he calls a second education. The second education is your emotional education, your sentimental education. The irony is that he calls this the second education, but then immediately says that it's the most important. But what we can take away from it is he's trying to highlight for us that we are trained, we are educated, not just formally and didactically and intellectually, but we are also being trained affectively, sentimentally, and emotionally, and that second sentimental education actually probably has a more significant impact on how you orient yourself in the world. At that gut level, what is happening is you are absorbing what Charles Taylor calls, a Canadian philosopher, ding, ding. The Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls a social imaginary. And what happens now is this is a way of kind of intuiting and attuning yourself to your world that you carry in your bones, and you never, hardly ever think about it, and yet it is shaping and orienting you all the time. Now, notice what Brooks says. I'm getting so excited, I'm breaking stuff. Brooks says, in fact, that kind of education happens not in classrooms and lecture halls and, dare we say, sermons, but in places like listening to the radio with Bruce Springsteen on, and it sort of, you absorb a way of imagining your world. That second education spills over the boundaries of the usual places we think of education happening, the usual spaces of pedagogy. Pedagogies of desire are everywhere. So listen to how he picks up on this. And he's thinking about education, and I obviously there's one way that we could apply this to schools. I want you to try to imagine what are the implications for thinking about this in terms of Christian education, in terms of discipleship, even in terms of preaching. This second education doesn't work the way scholastic education works. In a normal schoolroom, information walks through the front door and announces itself by the light of day. It's direct. The teacher describes the material to be covered, and then everybody works through it. By the way, David Brooks is clearly not a teacher. Okay, because even didactic education does not work like that exactly. Okay, but anyway. But the knowledge transmitted in an emotional education, on the other hand, comes indirectly, seeping through the cracks of the window panes, from under the floorboards and through the vents. The learning is indirect and unconscious. I find I can't really describe what this landscape feels like, especially in newspaper prose. But I do believe Springsteen's narrative tone, the mental map he has worked its way into my head, influencing the way I organize the buzzing confusion of reality, shaping the unconscious categories through which I perceive events. Just as being from New York or rural Georgia gives you a perspective from which to see this world, so spending time in Springsteen's universe inculcates its own preconscious viewpoint. Now, I think this is gold, but we have to jump a hurdle here, because if this is going to have anything suggestive to say to us as ministers, as Christian educators, as disciplers, as worship leaders, what we have to start entertaining is an odd idea, which is that there is some sense in which a Christian formation is pre-conscious. That there is some sense in which the gospel gets implanted in our bones at this non-conscious level. But don't therefore conclude that it's not important or directing you. In fact, it's directing you all the more because it is unconscious and pre-conscious. Does that make sense? This might be something we have to talk through. But in a way, think of it this way. I think modern bobblehead approaches to spiritual formation only entertain conscious formation. What they're not, and because of that, they are not attuned to habit formation, and because of that, they're not attuned to the way in which the Christian story, the gospel, is something that has to seep into our imagination so that it is even directing and orienting us at this preconscious level. That's what it would mean for Christian formation to be a sentimental education, is to get planted into our bones in exactly that way. That's kind of what I want to suggest intentional Christian liturgical formation does. It doesn't just didactically teach us the information about the gospel. By the way, it does that. It's that plus. What happens in the ritual is not a bad word for me. Are you with me? I know as Protestants, the R word is a bad word, But we really need to get over that, okay? For reasons I'm going to talk about. Because it's only if something becomes ritual in a good sense that it's going to, only if there's repetition is there formation. There is only formation where there is repetition. And we embrace and affirm ritual in all kinds of other spheres of our lives. Nobody is going to learn the violin or to play golf if they don't embrace ritual. If we are creatures of habit, and God has made us that way and knows that, then we need to get over a certain allergy we have to ritual. Because it's in ritual that now the story starts to soak in ways that you're not just always cognitively processing. And I'm going to suggest that that has significance. So think about the end of worship in this way. Here, let me try to paint a picture. Imagine that, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more, but imagine that a service of Christian worship has a narrative arc about it that in itself tells the story over and over and over again of God in Christ reconciling the world to himself, reconciling all things to himself. And in a way, I think the sort of narrative logic of Christian worship is very intentional in telling that story. So, for example, the fact that Christian worship historically starts with a call to worship. Let's talk about just a very simple thing. It would be interesting, I'm not going to do it, but it'd be interesting to know our experiences of the difference between congregations where worship begins with a very intentional call to worship as opposed to other congregations where worship begins when somebody starts playing the music. Okay? Now, there's what's going on in the call to worship thing is actually an announcement that God is the primary actor in worship. We are called to worship by the creator of the universe, who we know in Jesus Christ. And the initiative of Christian worship is divine. Now that in itself, I think, echoes creation. That's also the creation story. This is divine initiative. This is theocentric. This is God's work. And just as Adam and Eve are called to life, By the Creator God, so now we are called to new life in the call to worship. All right? So just a little, I think there's a lot at stake in little things that we do. So that starts a story. And now the story takes us through confession and assurance of pardon and confessing the creed together and hearing the word. And, you know, there's different ways of organizing this. I want to race ahead at this moment to think about the end of worship. So think of the bookends of worship. I think the call to worship is significant, and I think the end of worship is significant, which is a benediction. Okay? Now, also, you have to feel, and some of you might just not realize how many congregations do not end that way. I can't tell you, and I say this as somebody who has formed very significantly in those other kinds of congregations, it pains me to come now to the conclusion of Christian worship and somebody says, you're dismissed. Or, you know, and I love my Pentecostal brothers and sisters, but it usually goes something like this. These people are going to be at the altar a long time, so if the rest of you have to go, go ahead. You know, I get there's a certain pragmatic issue that we're working through there. But the reason why historically Christian worship has ended with a benediction is absolutely significant, because it is both a blessing and a charge. It's ascending, right? The culmination of Christian worship ends in sending. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord, right? Now that also, I think, echoes the creation narrative. Why is humanity called into existence? Because they are then given a commission to tend the earth, to be fruitful and multiply, to unpack all of creation's potential. This is what it means to bear the image of God, is to actually now be sent out into the world and do cultural labor that brings God glory and that unfurls and unpacks the potential of God's creation. So this is why I think the ultimate telos of Christian worship is to learn how to be human. The point of Christian worship is not to learn how to be superhuman, or to learn how to escape the world, or how to get your escape pod ready so that you can be ready for, you know, to get out of this terrible place. It's actually where you come to be reformed in Jesus Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, who finally shows us what it looks like to be human, and then you're sent back out into God's creation to take up the commission that was given to humanity at the beginning. But now, empowered by the Spirit, we might have a shot at some echo of doing that. Okay? Now, what that means then is there is this dynamic that characterizes the Christian life, which is both centripetal and centrifugal. Okay? So the reason why I think the center of Christian discipleship, not the whole of Christian discipleship, but the center of Christian discipleship is in gathered congregational worship, is because that is this centripetal gathering dynamic, where now we come together as the people of God who are reminded that this is our country, this is our citizenship, this is our allegiance, and together we are encountered by the one who has redeemed us and who now forms us by taking us through that story over and over and over again. We centripetally gather to keep reforming ourselves in light of that story, but the end of it is a centrifugal sending, where now we are the church sent in mission, and not just to do churchy things, but to do creational things. To do what humanity was placed to do, to tend the garden, to unfurl creation, to unpack all of its potential. So the end of worship is also the goal of worship in some ways. In some ways. I don't want to discount, obviously I think the ultimate telos is that God is glorified, and that we learn to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, right? But you glorify God and enjoy Him forever by bearing His image in the world. Okay? That's what it means. So the end of worship is being human, learning how to be human. And I think this is actually an important aspect of our evangelism and our witness. We're saying to people, look, this isn't the place where you come to learn to be inhuman. This is where you come to learn to be who you are called to be. That's what the gospel is. The gospel is an invitation to find ourselves in that. Now, so here's then not the shadow side, but the challenge that we need to recognize. If that is going to be a sentimental education, if sentimental educations, if pedagogies of desire work on this preconscious level, and if listening to Bruce Springsteen is an education in that sense, if it's formative, then we have to recognize that there are liturgies everywhere. There are liturgies everywhere. And what we have to try to discern is, what is the telos to which they prime us? Do you know what I mean? In other words, we need a new mode of cultural analysis. So even though ultimately I want this to be a positive, constructive vision where we now think anew with new intentionality about Christian formation, I also think it has a sort of critical aspect to it, which is this liturgical model of persons and formation should then also give us new eyes for looking at our cultural immersion. We need to now look at cultural practices and try to discern where and how they function as liturgies, or what I'm going to call secular liturgies. We have to recognize that in some ways, our immersion in cultural practices constitutes rival discipleship. So Christian discipleship is in some sense a competition. We need to recognize that cultural practices are implicit pedagogies of desire. They function as modes of covert worship. I think one of the motivations, I guess, for me to work on this project is actually to try to make sense of the extent to which the Christian church in North America has been overwhelmingly assimilated to the majority culture. Now, people as soon as you start talking that way, people think, fundamentalist, right? Which is unfortunate, because we're really just talking about holiness. We're talking about, there's a political way to talk about what we've just been saying, which is this, to be formed by the practices of Christian worship as the body of Christ is actually to be centered in the city of God. Right? What we're talking about is, how do we become citizens who bear our citizenship and allegiance within God's city? And if you take that seriously, what it means is you have to now have some account of how your allegiance to the risen King and your citizenship in the city of God at least complicates your participation in every other city, every other country, every other kingdom, every other polis, as some people put it, right? I think one of the reasons why in North American Christianity we have actually underestimated our assimilation is because we've been working with this sort of heady picture of things. And so our cultural analysis has tended to be fixated on the messages out there in culture. Right? So what we do is we listen for the ideas in culture. A lot of our cultural critique is concerned with discerning the messages and ideas and, so to speak, false doctrines that are in culture. And so you get totally fixated on those, but you don't realize that at the same time, actually, your habits and loves or longings have been totally recruited by other kingdoms. So you've got all your sort of doctrinal I's dotted and T's crossed, but you happily participate in the machinations of a consumerist culture. In fact, what you do is you come up with Christianized versions of a consumerist culture. And so you walk into the store and it's just filled with Christian crap for people to buy because they think it'll make them happy. That's believing another gospel. Okay? Sorry. Stuff. I'm Canadian. It gets worse, actually. So you could say one of the things that we're trying to deal with is how can we make sense of our assimilation? Our assimilation. In the circles I run in, I don't know if this is as true in the circles you run in, we talk a lot and we sort of pride ourselves a lot on being those Christians who are concerned with transforming culture. So what we do is we tell ourselves a story that we're not acultural holy huddlers who hide from the world. We recognize rightly that God's claim of kingship reigns over all of creation. There's not a single square inch of creation of which Christ does not say mine. That's just for Matt Kamen. And there is this robust vision that actually the gospel has something to say to every aspect of culture, and we are going to be the people who go transform culture. Does that sound at all familiar with folks? Okay. Yes, I'm all for it. Here's the only problem. Oftentimes, under the banner of our going out and transforming culture, do you know who gets transformed?
In the world, but not of it.
That's the dynamic that we should be going for. Here's why I think our best intentions of being engaged in transformation sometimes turn into our own assimilation is because we haven't recognized the power of secular liturgies. So we thought, oh, I've got my worldview in place. I've got my Christian ideas in place. I know what I think as a Christian. I'm going to go dive into this cultural sphere. I know what I want to say. I know what I want to think. I know how to discern bad ideas. But what you don't recognize is that there's this covert recruitment of your loves and longings that's happening at the same time. So I think we need a new mode of cultural analysis. And in a way, I think it's nothing short of apocalyptic. Now, I mean that in this sense. Because this will preach, by the way. Somebody should preach this. Okay. I'm thinking of the apocalypse, John's revelation. Okay. What's going on in Revelation? What I think we get is actually a revelation of the culture in which Christians find themselves. Now, what's interesting is, think of it this way. Do you know the kinds of blinds that you'll have on patio window, patio doors that are vertical louvered blinds? Vertical louvered blinds. So if you close them, they're like this. And when you open them, they go like that. And you can see right through them. It's almost invisible. Have you ever noticed that if you turn them like 45 degrees, straight on, you can't see through them. But if you lean like this, you can look right through them. I think of John's revelation as sort of looking at the empire. And imagine that really the empire is this kind of billboard that are louvered blinds at 45 degrees. And when you're looking at it straight on, what it does is it tells you this marvelous, beautiful, wonderful story about itself. The Pax Romana, civilization, accomplishment, power, prestige, all of these kinds of things. Here's the official story that you're being told about the culture in which you find yourself. It is the pinnacle of human civilization. But what's going on in John's revelation, what's apocalyptic about this, is not the sort of doomsday end time scenario. What's apocalyptic is how revealing it is, because it's as if John the Revelator invites us to just lean over. He says, oh, is that what you see? Come here, come here, come here. Look what's in there. You lean through, and what do you see? Beasts, monsters, whores. Right? In other words, don't buy the official story that looks all pretty and welcoming and wonderful. In fact, this is what God sees from heaven, is the monstrosities that are eating the people of God. But they're eating us in ways we don't even realize. You might even say those monstrosities are eating our loves at this unconscious level. And so what we need are new eyes to look at our cultural context. I really do sound like a fundamentalist when I talk like this. I'm not. I read The New Yorker every week. But I do think we have to recover a sense of what Abraham Kuyper called the antithesis. The antithesis. We've been very good, and again, I could be imposing my own story, but I think Christianity in North America, in evangelicalism, I think Chuck Colson's How Now Shall We Live was a watershed book, actually, as a cultural moment in the history of North American Christianity. And I actually taught that to a Pentecostal church in Los Angeles. It's a very good antidote to that sort of holy huddle, retreat from the world, acultural fundamentalism, but the danger is it spends so much time affirming common grace and saying, no, these are good things that we should be doing, that it then loses the sense of antithesis, which is saying, here's how the world is disordered. So let's think about this. Imagine now we are looking at culture not with idea focus, with an idea focus, but with a practices focus, and we're reading cultural practices as secular liturgies. So instead of asking about the messages of a culture, we should be asking questions like this. What vision of the kingdom is implicit in secular liturgies, right? That is, what story is embedded in this cultural practice? What does it functionally envision as the good life? What kind of people does it want us to become? What does this cultural institution want me to love? And I'm going to try one example. It'll actually work for us because we're a little older crowd. It doesn't work for the kids anymore, I don't think. But here's the example. When my kids ask to go to the mall, they say, Dad, will you take us to the temple? Now, they're kind of mocking me when they do this. But I'm okay with it because actually, you know, it's because they've absorbed a point which I've tried to make to them, which is this. The mall is not a neutral place. The mall is not just something that you do. It does something to you. The mall, and every town has one, is one of the cathedrals of the city. It's one of the temples to a consumer gospel. Now, how does that work? Well, it's not because you walk into the mall and somebody meets you there and says, here's our statement of faith. Right? Or here's the 16 fundamental truths of the mall. Or here's our catechism or whatever, right? It's not, there's no, the mall doesn't captivate us with a creed. It recruits our loves with a liturgy, though. Right? This is a training that really, quite intentionally, by the way, bypasses the intellect to work on our imaginations and our loves and our longings and desires. And that's why it's so effective. It has an incredible outreach strategy. It's called marketing. So all those 30-second spots that get you to come to those places are the most powerful evangelism in our culture, without question. We could wish to catch up to what Volkswagen does in 30 seconds. Now, how does Volkswagen do that? You don't get a ton of information about cars. Have you noticed that? Watch advertising. You do not get information about the products. You get stories about the kind of life that you will live if you had one of those products. Or it's often even more oblique than that. Here is a really cool life, and they just happen to be driving a Volkswagen. That it works narratively. It works on your imagination. It's not working on your deductive, rational processes. So think of marketing as this outreach program that invites us to now come to the temple of consumerism, which promises, what is the gospel? What it promises is that happiness is found in stuff. That joy is found in the novelty of new things. It's why you can't stop. Right? So when you come into, but now think of the mall as a cathedral. By the way, there actually is, Eric might know this too. I met an architectural historian at the University of Virginia who told me of a book on the history of mall design and that there are actually intentional echoes of sacred architecture in this project. Okay? But think of it, first of all, you drive up to a mall and, you can't really walk to a mall. Have you noticed that? Very, very hard to walk to a mall. Why? Because it's surrounded by this ocean of pavements where everybody is going to park their cars because it already is participating in a kind of commuter culture that is this mobilized culture. But you come there, and the great thing is the consumer gospel is incredibly Catholic in this sense. I know when I go to the mall in Spokane, I'm going to understand everything that's there. I'm going to recognize all the symbols. I'm going to recognize all of the labels. I'm going to it's just the replication of, we could wish that the uniformity of Christian witness around the world could be as universal and Catholic as the unbelievable uniformity of the witness of consumerism. Right? And that is, by the way, increasingly true outside of North America. Right, this is the dynamics of globalization. What's going on when I walk into a mall? Have you noticed that when you're inside a mall, you can never see outside? So one of the things that happens in the very affective space of a mall is it reconfigures space and time. So you are now sort of enclosed in a space that does funny things with light, so that ideally, it would be great if you lost any sense of time. There's almost a kind of eternity because it's, you never know what time it is. Because if the things are bent just right, it would be great if you lose yourself in there. Because the longer you're in there, the more likely you are to buy things. So there's very intentional design that sort of encloses you in this new space and time. So then you walk down. Why is it so many malls? I think this was more true when I was younger. Malls were places to get lost in. because they were totally labyrinthine. Do you know what I mean? Like you were, I remember White Oaks Mall in London, Ontario. I would like end up at the same store four times because I never knew where I was. But it's an interesting sort of meandering kind of space. Let's just talk about, you know, if you go to Gothic cathedrals in England or Germany, what's always fascinating are all the chapels alongside a cathedral. And what I still can't get in my head is there would be stuff going on concurrently within those chapels and all this activity happening. Well, now think of all those stores lining the labyrinth of the mall as little chapels alongside. And what's going on when my 14-year-old daughter is in there is, again, nobody's offering her any information, but what is are in there are basically 3D icons of the good life called mannequins, right? It's not the flat stained glass. It's actually this sort of picture of this is what it is to be attractive. This is what it is to be cool. This is what it is to be hip. This is, you know, what you can tell I'm not any of those things because I don't even know how to talk about it. But there is this dynamic where what's happening there is a picture of a good life that operates on us at this unconscious level. Anyway, we could spin this out much longer. What's happening is you are breeding a sense of happiness and the good life that is bound up with consumption. It is bound up with novelty because whatever you just bought 4 months ago is so 5 minutes ago, right? So last season. So now you need to keep consuming for part of that thrill. We even talk about now retail therapy. Right? Somebody's down. Well, let's go shopping. I'll feel better if I buy something new. The glitz of novelty. There's a justice story here that we're not telling, which is when we keep consuming stuff and throwing it away, what are we doing to our resources? There is a justice story here which says, do you know why I can keep buying stuff constantly all year for $6.99 at Old Navy? Because there are people laboring in unjust conditions on the other side of the world that I know nothing about. There is a dark underbelly to the way of life that we can enjoy in this consumer gospel that is never intellectualized, right? Never ever reflected on. And so what happens is we need to recognize that the mall is not just something that you do. It does something to you. Now, what do you do with that information? Do you not go? I'm actually all for that. But I'm not going to suggest. We do need to think through, are there seasons, times, contexts in which Christians do undertake a kind of intentional abstention from certain cultural practices? Not because culture itself is bad, but because this particular configuration of culture is so disordering. We're not going to settle that question. I think it's a question of Christian prudence, how one thinks about that. At least I hope this. I feel like some of my work is already done when my kids play along with the joke and say, can you take me to the temple? Because at least it means the radar is up a little bit. Now, that might get folded away and put away when they get there. You know, that's part of the challenge. But there is at least something at stake, and this is where the positive, the good of intellectual reflection, right? What part of discipleship could be is inviting people to actually reflect on their cultural immersion with these liturgical eyes to see what's at stake. We could run this with all kinds of other cultural institutions. So I'm, for example, I am a recovering, I'm doing much better, NASCAR fan. Okay? Now, for me, what is the most disconcerting about NASCAR is actually the opening ceremonies. It's not unlike the opening ceremonies of a lot of other professional sports, which are, to me, our stadiums are actually not temples of sport. They often actually function as temples of nationalism. so that the opening of a NASCAR race, the NASCAR races are particularly challenging for this reason. You know, the race is going to open with obviously the national anthem. Have you ever asked yourself just why we do the national anthem at sporting events? Like, if you go to the symphony, do they start with the national anthem? How did that happen? Well, it could be because of the sort of contest that characterizes a lot of our sports. There's a resonance here. Your national anthem, fairly militaristic. Okay? How is every national anthem going to end at a big event like this? At a NASCAR race, it will always end with a military flyover. I don't care if the only thing in the neighborhood are Apache helicopters. Some military vehicle is going to fly across the stadium. And if you've ever experienced a military flyover, you don't see military flyovers. You feel military flyovers. They are overwhelming. And the symbolism that's going on here of power that is now bound up with these events. And at NASCAR races, here's what adds to the weirdness of it. Every NASCAR race opens with prayer. You didn't know that, did you? It's kind of ugly. Because actually, really the only thing the prayer can be is to the God of American civil religion. What else could you do? Right? And so what we recognize, and then obviously we're not all going to NASCAR races, but there's a sort of training there that is then micro-repeated at every high school football game. And every, you know, there's a liturgy at stake there that trains us into a certain vision of the good life. The other example I'll just hint at, this is talked about more in Desiring the Kingdom. Thomas Wolfe, sort of a edgy novelist, has a great novel from about 10 years ago now probably called I Am Charlotte Simmons. If you have teenagers going to college, don't read it. It will be harrowing. Actually, no. Read it and then send them to Whitworth. Because, or Calvin. But what he does is he basically diagnoses the story or recounts the story of young Charlotte Simmons, who goes to University of North Carolina. It's called something else, but and basically documents how she thinks the university is all about ideas, but actually the experience is all about her body. In athletics, in sexuality, in the frat house. What happens is Charlotte Simmons thinks she's going to go get her mind educated, but what happens is her heart is educated through her embodiment. And she underestimated the power, I would say, of the secular liturgies operating in that context. Those are all just samples. I think the analysis of secular liturgies has to be very contextual. You know, what the secular liturgies in Canada, for example, are totally different. We actually don't have any because it's just the kingdom of God. No. It's funny. You know, I live in the States for almost 20 years now. And so when I go home to Canada, all my cultural examples don't work. The temptations are different. That will be true everywhere. But I also think regionally, even in the United States, what it looks like to analyze secular liturgies in Manhattan is going to look very different than Seattle, is going to look very different than Lincoln, Nebraska. You know, this is why you have to do the hard work of doing this analysis for your congregations. I would say this is part of the function of a pastor, is to, in a way, be an ethnographer of the secular practices that we are immersed in. And I'm giving the impression that this is a wholly negative thing. It's not an all or nothing. Because you could also analyze cultural practices and come to conclusions and say, actually, you know what? All things considered, those are kind of bent more towards the kingdom than others. Right? So it's not just a negative analysis. Okay, for the sake of time, we'll pick this up tomorrow. But what you then start to realize is, if that's the analysis of secular liturgies, I hope you feel like it raises the stakes of Christian liturgical formation. Christian liturgical formation now has to be intentional, precisely so that it can be the right formation. You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. How now can we come up with liturgies that compete and counter those formations? See, it's not going to work for us to say, recognize that our young people are immersed in all these cultural practices, and then all we give them are ideas. You're trucking water to the wrong fire. You need to, at the same time, find ways for the gospel to recruit their imaginations and loves and longings. And as I've been suggesting, I actually think the church knew that long ago. So we don't have to, I don't feel like it's a big burden. It's like, oh no, what are we going to do now? What we have to do is remember. Remember. So tomorrow I'll talk about how, what these spiritual disciplines do and what Christian liturgical practices do is they impact our imaginations. And we'll talk over the next couple of days about why that is. Let me close with this. John Calvin, as you know, the reformers were not big fans of monasteries. In fact, I have visited the ruins of monasteries in northern England, which are a really heartbreaking story because in some ways my people, Protestants, destroyed them. But Matthew Myers Bolton has written a fantastic book, which I've noted in your packet, called Life in God, about John Calvin's practical theology. And he notes that Calvin's understanding of monasteries was very different. He was critical of monasteries. And in a way, he wanted to knock down the walls of monasteries, but not because he thought what was going on in the monasteries was wrong or bad. It's because he wanted all of Geneva to be a monastery. Now, what does that mean? Calvin wanted to knock down the walls of the monastery, not to stop the spiritual disciplines that were happening there, but to expand them to encompass not just priests and nuns, but butchers and bakers and candlestick makers as well. He envisioned Geneva as a magnum monasterium, by which he simply meant that the whole life of the city would be governed by morning psalms and evening psalms and the rituals of Christian practice that would then frame how the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker go about their good cultural labor. I think it is a moment in North American Christianity for the church to re-entertain that sort of monastic vision, not as a huddled vision, but as a disciplined community. What would it look like for the church's witness, for us to be a people who are rhythmed by those Christian practices, by those prayers, by those kinds of monastic disciplines, and then be sent into our cultural labors and context? That's, I actually think, what the future of Christianity in North America needs, and that's part of this project.